It's no secret that I'm a devoted coffee lover, so much so that I don't care where my coffee comes from or when it was roasted. Not! All coffee lovers know that the secret to baking the best cup of coffee is starting with freshly roasted beans, which is why it's time to switch to Sparkplug coffee. That's right, Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including your next new favorite. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this excellent coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that you're only drinking fresh coffee at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or take advantage of their autopilot set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, that's all one word, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? You are worthy. You are worthy. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100 Project
and action.
Game on. Hey kids, and thank you for being us, Victor saying what, as you listen to the next 143 Project, the every Monday analysis of various classic movies. We started reviewing films nearly 6 years ago by talking about the 123 flicks that ranked on the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of American film excellence. Excellent. Party done. Party on. Ever since we finished that, we've been reviewing whatever we feel like. Spoiler alert, you psycho hose beasts. I'm the captain of the Mirthmobile who likes to play. And here's a lady who needs to learn to live in the now. My wife, Bev.
That's me.
I love you, man.
I love you.
No, I love you, man.
I love you.
Just say thank you.
Thank you.
We've covered a lot of the quotes already from this movie. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Wayne's World. My favorite scene is the one with Alice Cooper, who has detailed knowledge of a certain U.S. city. What city is that, and what does Cooper say the city's name means in Algonquin?
The city is Milwaukee, or, as the Algonquin pronounce it, Milwaukee.
I've always pronounced Milwaukee, Milwaukee, ever since. Maybe not the first time I saw this movie, but certainly in the many years since.
It's not that often that you have the opportunity to talk about Milwaukee in any context, but it is Algonquin for the good land.
And did you know they've elected 3 socialist mayors?
I did not. I know it now.
I did not know that. Does this guy know how to party or what? I watched that scene again on YouTube before we sat down here. I think one of my favorite parts about it is when the other guy in the band, Pete, pipes up. In fact, isn't Milwaukee an Indian name? Yes, Pete, it is. Alice Cooper may not be a great actor, but he is very funny in that 3 minutes of screen time he has.
Apparently they sprung it on him. He didn't know he was going to do lines at all. He thought he was just going to perform. He was proud of how quickly he banged through it, and he didn't let them break him up. They didn't crack.
And it leads to one of the most famous moments in this movie that's taken a life of its own. I think they did it before anyone else did. The, we're not worthy, we're not worthy.
I think they started in SNL.
Okay, well, there you go. If we say that this movie initiated, it's the sketch that became this movie. And actually, Mike Myers did this character on Canadian television in the 80s before he even did it on SNL.
On a show called It's Only Rock and Roll.
Okay, before we get any further, we probably should acknowledge that we're still taking care of another dog here, Cheddar, and she might be a little loud and annoying. This should be the last time we have a podcast with her. And of course, Tilly and Sam are also in the vicinity, so you might hear some noises. They do dog things.
Yeah, we had Fox and Sam pretty well trained, but Cheddar is not. She has no idea what it's like to record a podcast. Frankly, dog, you know nothing about broadcasting.
We have dozens of people that are waiting for this podcast, Cheddar. Okay, Wayne's World was released by Paramount on Valentine's Day, 1992. And it was a colossal hit. I think it surprised a lot of people just how big a hit it was. It's still, or at least it was, the biggest SNL sketch that became a movie. Because Blues Brothers was huge, but this was even huger.
And it still is, yeah.
And some of the other ones, like Coneheads and It's Pat, didn't succeed at all. The Ladies' Man, another one. To Meadow
Night
sketch.
Of the Roxbury.
Right. Most of them were failures.
It had more misses than hits.
But Bev, remind people what this 27-year-old movie is about with Wayne's World Skinny.
Mike Myers is Wayne and Dana Carvey is Garth, the metalhead hosts of a popular public access show who get their big break when a shady TV exec, played by Rob Lowe, buys the show. And as shady TV execs are wont to do, this one immediately sells out the show to a sponsor and tries to steal Wayne's girlfriend. So Wayne and Garth hatch a plan to win back their show and their girl, a plan that has about twice as much pelvic thrusting as you remember. Even if you remember this film having a lot of pelvic thrusting, I promise you, it's more.
You mean swing,
swing, right? Like really aggressive putting their back into it pelvic thrusting.
Or in a nutshell, sexiest bass player who ever lived dates minor celebrity who is remarkably out of his league.
I know they keep joking about it in the movie. How did you get this girl? You do not deserve her. You are not worthy.
Tia Carrere is one of the hottest women ever, I think, in this movie. And in True Lies a couple years later. She was in the sequel as well. That was, I think, 92, 93, 94. And then she really wasn't anything all that big after that, which is a shame because she's not the best actor of all time, but she's pretty good. And talk about easy on the eyes. And in True Lies, she's a pretty good villain.
Agreed. I didn't really know what happened to her.
And I forgot she was not only the lead singer, but the bass player, hence my nutshell. Okay, Rotten Tomatoes numbers. 84% of critics like the film. 42 fresh, 8 rotten, and 84% of audiences as well. The sequel has 61% of Rotten Tomatoes. I thought it'd be less than that because I don't think that many people seemed to like the movie when it came out, but the critics obviously just barely gave it a passing grade. And it was 8th at the 1992 U.S. box office. Aladdin was number 1. Unforgiven, the best picture winner, was number 11. And between you, me, and Chris, we've covered a lot of movies from this year. And this is one of the biggest hits of all, and I'm a little bit surprised to say it's one of the best movies from that year. I think in retrospect, it wasn't my favorite movie of that year, but I laughed. What about you?
It was a cultural juggernaut, too. It's impossible to determine how much of my love for this movie is fueled by nostalgia, because I was 14 when Wayne's World came out, which is the ideal age to enjoy this movie. I probably spoke in exclusively Wayne's World quotes for the remainder of that school year. And I still find it just delightful. It really strikes a chord for me. I wouldn't show this to like a 20-year-old and expect them to get anything about it. But for us, it's aged well.
The best thing in this movie, I talked about the best scene, but the best character in this movie, the best actor in this movie is Dana Carvey.
Oh my God, Garth.
And I think that stuff ages pretty well. This movie is big on homages to previous songs and previous scenes. There's a Psycho reference. There's a lot of references in this movie. A lot of them that Garth does, including the Psycho reference.
There's Grey Poupon references.
Right. That is something that would definitely not be all that relevant to young people. I barely remember any of that. I do remember seeing that commercial when I was young, but vaguely. Mike Myers has created 4 iconic characters in his career. He's only made about 20 movies, just a little more than that, including recently, he was in Bohemian Rhapsody. But he's got 4 iconic characters. Wayne Campbell in this movie, Austin Powers and Dr. Evil in the Austin Powers movies, and Shrek. So for whatever people have said about the guy over the years, and it sounds like he's been tough to work with, including with his director on this film, Penelope Spheeris, he fought with her a lot during production, and then he kept her from directing the sequel. And I also read somewhere that he didn't really want to share the spotlight with Dana Carvey. Now, he had on the sketch before, so I'm a little bit surprised as if it's to say that it would just be him in the movie and some of Dana Carvey. And Myers is funny, but he's outshadowed by his own co-star in a good way. There's a lot of funny people in this movie. But Carvey's the best thing, and he hasn't really acted that much since this film. He's done a lot of voiceover work since then, and some stuff with Adam Sandler. I guess they're friends from the SNL days, and it's a shame because the guy's hysterical.
He was the biggest star of his SNL era.
Carvey or Myers?
Carvey. Carvey was.
I think Myers might have been a bigger star, but
he became
Carvey...
a bigger star, but, you know, at the time that Wayne's World started on SNL, it was considered a favor that Carvey would be a little bit player in his thing, and for whatever reason, he agreed to do it. He said that the only direction that Mike Myers gave him when he was creating the character of Garth was just, Garth loves Wayne. Mm-hmm. And he let him do everything else from there, and he based the character loosely on his own brother, who's like a dorky engineer, and apparently just that sweet and humble. So he has all kinds of little homages to his brother in the character, and he is the heart of the film. He is so childlike and innocent and guileless.
And he also fell on his keys. That's an homage to the producers. Yeah. I think we talked about that when we covered the producers last fall, because it's Gene Wilder saying it in that film. One thing about this movie that I don't think was that common back then, but it has become common, especially in TV shows, is it's often treated like an Office-esque documentary. They talk right to the camera. I guess it's supposed to be a gag. It's not supposed to be a fake documentary. But there's plenty of times, obviously Wayne especially, but Garth also does sometimes. And then towards the end when Wayne is bitching about how things are going, the camera pulls away. No, no, come on back. I'm sorry. It's not that bad.
Meta, before meta was a thing. Mm. Ferris Bueller talks to camera. So it's kind of homaging that kind of stuff or just playing on that kind of stuff. There's also a really funny moment when the manager of the donut shop starts talking about his time in Nam, and he gets really dark, and then Wayne's like, oh yeah, it's Ed O'Neill, that's right. And Wayne comes back, he's like, no, you don't talk to camera. This is just
so at least three people in this movie talk to the camera, unlike Ferris Bueller, where it's just him that does it.
And there's other meta stuff in it, the sponsorship gag, which is one of the most famous scenes, other than the really obvious Bohemian Rhapsody scene. Mm-hmm. One of the famous scenes is the sponsorship gag, where they're really obviously complaining about sponsors while dressed in Reebok stuff and drinking Pepsi and eating Doritos.
And also taking Advil, or no, Excedrin, Buffer, what's it called?
Oh, what is it? Oh, I have...
Little Yellow Different.
It's not on the market anymore, it's Nuprin.
Oh, that's
Little Yellow Different. Nuprin.
That commercial, I remember that, black and white, but then the actual pill is yellow.
They just turn the bottle over and just two pills come out perfectly. And for the time, Wayne's World was a kind of weird movie. Like, it was relying on some pretty risky gags, like the cameraman ditching Wayne while he's at his lowest point. And the weirdness in itself kind of contributes to the laughs because it was so surprising when stuff like that would happen, the triple ending.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it broke my brain the first time I saw it. And it works! It's high levels of difficulty, but the payoff is extraordinary.
The apocalyptic ending, the Scooby-Doo ending, and then the actual happy ending, where everything works out. And in my opinion, Mr. Big just wants to bang Cassandra.
Because she's not even performing one of her own songs!
Exactly. Why would Crucial Taunt not play an original song to get noticed? They're playing Ballroom Blitz, which is a good tune. They're doing fine with it. He sees maybe 45 seconds of that on his little television. Has the limo driver turn around. They somehow get to Wayne's house just as the band is finishing the song. None of that math works out. I'm going to give you a 4 or even a 5 record deal. Based on that, he wants to fuck her.
And it's funny how in a movie that's all about how the big executive screws them over, the happy ending is her getting a deal with a big executive.
A bigger executive, probably.
Yeah.
That's Tootie from Goodfellas, Frank DeLeo, whatever his name is. He's the brother of Polly. Let's go back to the beginning, though, because the whole film starts with Noah's Arcade, that commercial. In the beginning, the first thing we hear is Brian Doyle Murray's voice as he talks about Noah's Arcade, which is a clever little thing. Apparently his wife came up with that. Colleen Camp plays Mrs. Vanderhoff. Noah's Arcade's kind of catchy.
I know, they're making fun of it, that she's like, I came up with a name, Noah's Arcade, I opened my mouth, and it just came out. And he's like, that's amazing, but it's actually kind of amazing. It's a pretty cool name for an arcade.
And then Wayne mocks him when the guy's actually on camera, but he seems like a pretty decent guy. Yeah, he's older, not with it, but he's trying. He's not being
this
an ass
like
about anything.
One of the most 90s things about the movie, remember a time when selling out was looked down upon? People under 30 must be straight up mystified by a scene where Wayne and Garth bristle at the idea of including sponsored content in their homemade TV show. Once upon a time, it was real credibility killer to be in the pocket of any kind of advertisers. Now it's people's express goals when they're creating something, be they musicians or YouTubers or influencers. Watching this now, I actually feel bad for Noah Vanderhoff. He's just trying to run an arcade. He actually runs a far more sympathetic business than any of the movie's actual sponsors, like Pepsi and Nuprin.
Mm-hmm. And then soon after that, it's the most famous scene in the whole film, Bohemian Rhapsody, a song that was not in the zeitgeist anymore.
It's the first time I ever heard that song.
I think that's true for a lot of people. The studio wanted a Guns N' Roses song instead, and Mike Myers stood his ground so much that he was going to quit. And don't forget, this was a TV guy who had never acted before. He did co-write the script, obviously a lot of influence with Lorne Michaels, who produced the movie as well. He took time off, as he has, for other sketches that became movies, from SNL to the big screen. So Michaels must have backed up the star, and I think Penelope Spheeris must have had an awful lot of trouble with that, probably, too. How could she not,
well,
when the producer's siding with the actor over her? But Meyer stood his ground to the point where, if we don't have Bohemian Rhapsody in this, I'm off.
But then apparently he fought the opposite after it was shot, or during the shoot, he was angry that it was taking too long and it was hurting his neck to headbang. And then in post-production, he didn't think it was funny. He didn't think it was going to work. He wanted Spheeris to take the scene out, and she refused. It's one of the many things that they butt heads about.
Yeah, they all look like they have sore necks. Well, at least Wayne and Garth do. The guys in the back are doing more of the actual headbanging, flapping their hair every which way. It's also an interesting note, and I think this is on the making of, where Dana Carvey talks about not knowing the lyrics. The part at the end that, ooh. Carvey's not actually singing the right lyrics, but that actually makes sense because maybe Garth isn't quite with it. He's a little bit dumb, so he doesn't actually know what he's supposed to be singing.
And then apparently that was an accident because Carvey just didn't know the lyrics, but Spheeris kept it in. Because it's hilarious.
It's a
really
mistake.
Cute.
Yeah. I didn't notice it until they pointed that out when I watched the movie after that. Oh, of course, and now I can't not notice it, but it's actually a benefit. And after all the Mandarin we had last week in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, now we have Cantonese,
yeah,
including that subtitle gag. And part of the gag is that the subtitles go on longer than the actual dialogue, which is the reverse of what happens in most movies, where what they're saying in the other language, in this case Cantonese, might be 20 or 30 words, but what's actually subtitled is, yes, let's go to there.
Well, it's a funny gag for anybody who watched Kung Fu movies growing up, because very often the subtitles would be this embarrassing, simplified version of whatever the characters actually said. And it would seem like that they either talked for a long time, and there was very little text on the screen, or they didn't talk very much, and there was a lot of text on the screen. I think it's just a failure of translations for lazy, cheap translators.
But Myers and Carrere just sit there and wait for the credits.
Yeah.
Not the credits, but the subtitles to play out as they're boringly looking off into the distance.
Another one of the cute meta touches.
I think it's after Wayne meets Cassandra, the plane scene where they're watching planes. I guess some of that was improvised. I read it was at the end of the shoot. Everyone was just exhausted. It's enough. Let's get the hell out of here. And Myers actually has a legitimate laugh when Carvey says, you ever find Bugs Bunny attractive when
you put on a dress? Like a girl.
No. And he actually starts laughing for real. It was actually apparently from some other joke, and they made it work as if it was from that joke. Bugs Bunny being attractive? Okay, I guess. I can't remember.
Well, it reminds me of Crumb, just to take a deep dive into a totally different movie. But there's a scene in Crumb where he admits that he was sexually attracted when he was a boy Bugs Bunny, period. Not even when he was wearing a dress.
The other guys who work as the crew on the show, they get a fair amount of screen time. I like the scene where they have to learn to count down from five, and then Wayne and Garth are actually mouthing along. They have to be told not to do that. They're pretty lovable sidekicks. The drunk guy they pick up, who's part of the Bohemian Rhapsody thing, I like that too, that he's just between the two big guys in the back seat, just about ready to spew or hurl.
This is your no-hurl guarantee.
But then he actually starts singing the song too.
Yeah. And then for the entire movie, no matter what they're doing, he always seems like he's about to pass out drunk.
We already covered the Alice Cooper concert, and they actually played for a little while. You hear Frankenstein, was that Be My Frankenstein, where that song is?
Or Feed My Frankenstein.
That's it, yeah, right. But I do like the touch when Wayne and Garth go backstage, and they're constantly showing their passes to everybody. They're such nerds.
Yeah.
You don't need to show them to just girls standing there. You're already back there, but it's a funny touch. It's a cute touch.
They're so earnest about everything. It's part of the charm.
And they know that they are not worthy. What plot there is towards the end where Wayne has to try to save things for Cassandra to get her career back on track and to get his girlfriend back. The Impossible Mission, including the Mission Impossible music, another homage in this movie. At least they acknowledge it's absurd. And when Garth lays it all out, you hear it and think, that would never work. But I think the movie at least knows that.
It's kind of making fun of its own formula, because it's an incredibly formulaic, I don't want to say rock movie, but the whole obscure artist gets discovered, gets screwed over by their record contract, and then has to emancipate themselves and beat the evil record exec or what have you. It's all a cliche, so they're always tongue-in-cheek making fun of that, and that very much includes the ending, which is so silly.
What do you think of Rob Lowe as Benjamin? He's an ass-licker in the movie. He was a Brat Packer before this. This was a bit of a comeback for him after that scandal where he was with the underage girl.
Yeah, scandal that certainly would ruin him today, but he has fully recovered and everyone has tidily forgotten about it. And before this, he had never done comedy. He was really just a dramatic actor, so he was kind of learning on the spot.
And he wasn't great in this movie, I think.
He's not playing comedy. He's playing just a straight-up evil guy. He's not really trying to do gags. And he's fine, yeah. I'm not crazy about him. I've liked him way more in things since this, like Parks and Rec.
I never saw Parks and Rec, but I heard he was funny in that.
He's Thank You for Smoking.
He steals the Liberace movie with Michael Douglas.
Oh, my God.
As the plastic surgeon. Yeah. And, of course, the West Wing, where he's got some comedy elements. That's more of a dramedy than, well, I guess more of a drama, actually.
God, he's had a great career when you think about it.
A great second career, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
His anal probing towards the end, that doesn't really age very well.
Mm-mm.
Although we do see him going to Wayne's house three times. Sphincter. Clenched pretty tight.
Yeah, there's a handful of jokes that didn't age that well in that respect, but less than I would have expected. Less than a lot of other movies that I've revisited, even movies that are much younger than Wayne's World.
Yeah. Chris and I have discovered that with all of our sports movies that so often, and around this time, we've covered, I think, at least three movies from 1992 he and I have, and there'll be more, I'm sure, in the future, where they are so out of touch, which we can't really hold against movies from 1992. 2002, even then.
But it's refreshing to go back and watch a movie like this and, oh, thank God, there's no rampant homophobia or sexism.
Wayne and Garth are nice guys for the most part. So are their friends. Wayne is a pretty good boyfriend. They have fun together. When they start really clicking, it's not about, well, of course, he does want to be with her sexually, but it's more about him wanting to be friends with her. He likes her. And then the sex is almost a bonus.
They go to the guitar shop and she knows all about the guitar and she's talking shop with him. That's what impresses him, and impresses him that she can play bass and that she's a great rocker chick, front woman of a band that he likes.
Or when he sings, hey, Mickey, you're so fine, you blow my mind, hey, Mickey, and she gets into that. Her silly music video towards the end, where Benjamin's finally tossed off by her, and the exhausted python. I think maybe the snake's not supposed to be quite as indifferent as it is in the movie. It's supposed to not be working, because that's why the scene ends, and she's mad at the snake. But then, when they get towards the craft services table, if you look, the thing is almost going off camera. I have a feeling the trainer's trying to hold it. Okay, you can't just go right off. You have to be part of the shot here. And then there's that line, which implies Benjamin's done the wrong thing, or at least wants to, where she says, when he's behind her, "Is that you? Or is that the snake?"
But it is the snake.
But I think the idea being that you're a snake and you're wrapping your arm around me or maybe goosing me.
Yeah.
Because it could be that she's saying that he's actually touching her ass. We can't see from that angle. I don't know.
The song, it's just a terrible song. Their original song, the
Why You Wanna Break My Heart. That's been in my head the last couple days, though.
Me too! I can't get it out of my head. It's the worst earworm ever.
Isn't that the song that they're doing the music video for?
I think so, yeah.
But you're saying that's bad.
Yes, it's a bad song.
Well, it's in our heads. It can't be that bad if we are actually singing it in our heads.
It's worse because it's in my head. Just that same part over and over again. It's really repetitive in the movie, and it's just really repetitive in my head.
And yet, that is not the song they're playing when they want to get noticed by Mr. Big.
Yeah, they're investing all this money in the music video, but when they went and went over the record exec, do a cover. Don't think too hard about it. Just wear a sexy dress and do a song that everybody already likes.
Chris Farley is the reason why they know about Mr. Big in the first place. And I like, again, how they get meta.
Another, yeah.
He knows a lot for a security guard. And Chris Farley, in his debut, is doing a lot of the Chris Farley things. The gestures, the, here's the car, and he's going here, and he's going there.
And this is before he was a big star. He became another huge SNL breakout star before his untimely and very tragic death.
I did not recognize Meatloaf as the bouncer What's it called? The Gasworks? I think Mike Myers...
Gasworks? Oh, maybe you're right.
I guess it's Gasworks. It's Gasworks. And Mike Myers based that on a place where he's from in Scarborough or somewhere around here in Toronto because he's actually from Scarborough.
And as you say that, we've got to bring up all the Canadian connections.
Well, one of the things that's a Canadian connection is actually something I didn't really click on the first few times I saw the movie. I should have. Stan Mikita's Donuts is a play on Tim Horton's Donuts. Although Stan Mikita was a superstar in the NHL for the Chicago Blackhawks, and Tim Horton was a pretty good player for the Leafs, as I recall. But then he started a donut shop. Stan Mikita is supposed to be a reference to that. But he was a star, and Horton wasn't.
I don't think I knew until I was like 20 years old that Tim Horton was a hockey player. So there's that. There's the fact that they play road hockey is very Canadian thing. Like, that is an incredibly Canadian thing.
Game on!
The fact that Myers, as we already mentioned, developed the character in the first place on Canadian television. His Canadian accent, which he does literally nothing to cover up. And listen, I have my own thick Canadian accent, so I can't judge. Also, there's a ton of similarities between this movie and Strange Brew. Well, I guess not a ton of similarities, but it's these two local dopes with a basic cable show just talking about whatever they feel like talking about. So you could say Wayne's World was his play on Bob and Doug McKenzie to begin with. The plot of the movie is quite different from the plot of Strange Brew.
So the reason why the whole talking to the camera thing isn't as out of left field as it maybe would be because they're talking to a camera in the first place when they do their show. So it actually makes some sense they would do that when they're not doing the show. Some movies would jam it in there. I've never seen The Office. I saw the British one, a couple episodes at least. I assume they make that make sense. Well, they're supposed to be filming them doing their job. Is that the idea? It's a documentary.
Yeah, it's
making.
Like a documentary about a workplace. But the way it works with the cameras, they have the confessionals, but whenever somebody does something stupid, which is always Steve Carell or Rainn Wilson, then somebody else will look in the camera in a conspiratorial way, like, did you see that?
Okay. Laura Flynn Boyle plays Stacy, and we talked about the hockey scene where she has, well, obviously it's a stunt person, but she has that great gag where it's, hi, Wayne, hi, doesn't see a parked car on her bicycle and blasts her over the top of it and flies over the other side.
Her whole character is the weirdest joke. You think it's going to go somewhere, that she's going to either save the day or be the villain in the end, but it's really just this running gag out of nowhere for nothing, but it's funny.
It provides one of Dana Carvey's better lines, and he's got so many great ones. But when she says to him, when he's waiting in line to go to the bathroom, what do I got to do to get him back? Or whatever she says to him, and he says something like, forget about it, move on. Just a matter of fact. He doesn't want you anymore. Stop obsessing about him.
They're not mean to anybody, but they can be mean to her because nothing seems to get through to her. I love the rant about the gun rack.
That's based
so
on a real
weird
thing, too. Myers had a girlfriend that, I guess, bought him a gun rack.
I love that. I don't own a gun, let alone so many guns that I need a rack to put them
on. Well, you mentioned that he bases a lot of this on being Canadian, but the movie is set in Aurora, Illinois, which is not a real place. I guess it's supposed to be a bit of a play on Sherman, Illinois, also not a real place that John Hughes used.
Mm. But there is a suburb of Toronto called Aurora.
Yeah, but they are setting this in Illinois.
I'm saying he's from Toronto, and he named his fake suburb after an actual suburb of Toronto.
Mm. Yeah, right, okay. Brian Doyle Murray, who's, of course, Bill's brother, the mayor in Groundhog Day. We covered that a few years ago. And then he's the bad boss in Christmas Vacation. He is Noah Vanderhoff. And again, I thought he was a pretty, maybe not funny character, but he was a good character. Russell's a pretty big part of the film. Kurt Fuller, he's one of those that guy actors. He's been in about 50 flicks in his 30 or so year career and a ton of TV.
Which actor was it?
Kurt Fuller. The guy who plays Russell, Benjamin's assistant, when they're doing a TV show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he is one of those guys.
Well, there's another good gag that Danny Carvey has. He's got just a simple flashlight. Give me the flashlight, Russell. And then he gets it away from us like it's... No, wait, guys. It's okay. It's like it's a gun or something or a knife. It's a pretty funny gag, too. Oh, Danny Carvey. I did not remember or recognize at all that Ione Skye is the lady friend in the opening scene with Benjamin, because that's what the whole start of the movie is. Him in bed with a girl, his girlfriend maybe, and that's Ione Skye from Say Anything.
I didn't recognize her either.
As I'm looking up during the scene, I'm thinking, okay, I can see it now, but it had been about only 3 years, actually. I don't know why she looks so different. She was really young in Say Anything, so maybe she just blossomed and grew up that much more. Then there's that funny gag, Robert Patrick still playing the T-1000. Apparently Myers didn't think that worked or was funny, and yet the preview audiences loved it.
I loved it when it happened.
His hair had grown back by that point. It was only about a year later. Not even a year after Terminator 2 came out, actually. And then Donna Dixon is the dream woman. She is Dan Aykroyd's wife. So there's a callback to an SNL character as well, I guess. A guy who also had a very famous sketch in Blues Brothers that became a big movie. And she is beautiful. Great dream woman. I believe it's Kim Basinger who plays a different dream woman in the sequel that Garth obsesses about.
Yeah, along with Heather Locklear.
Oh, she's in that movie. Too, yeah. I haven't seen Wayne's World 2 in a long time. I don't remember much of it. I know there's some big concert that they put on.
Wayne Stock or something.
That's right, yeah.
Lee Tergesen plays one of their guys, one of their TV crew, who's in the car with them all the time. And he's another one of those guys, kind of like Kurt Fuller. Yeah, you know him, you recognize him from stuff. He's the lead in the old HBO show Oz. And he's been in a lot of other smaller things since then. You would recognize him.
Well, the other guys in the group, I believe, Michael DeLuise, who was on 21 Jump Street, the TV show.
Huh.
All right, Penelope Spheeris. Right after this, she went on to do Beverly Hillbillies and Little Rascals. So she did some TV adaptations that were pretty crappy as far as I remember. But I guess her biggest thing, other than Wayne's World, would be The Decline of Western Civilization. She did, I think, two of those.
There's three. TV? Okay. She did a third one.
TV documentaries, were they, or were they films?
I think they were theatrical films, and especially the original Decline of Western Civilization is considered a classic of the documentary genre. She also directed this cult film called Suburbia, which is a terrible movie, but a huge cult hit in my crummy small town that I grew up in. I remember everybody loved it. It's like about homeless punks. It's so bad. She got hired because she could work fast, and they wanted a director that could do this on little budget and in a short time.
This would have been during the summer break for the SNL people, yeah. Obviously, for Myers and Carvey, and for that matter, Farley, I think, was on the show by that point.
And the second part of The Decline of Western Civilization was about metalheads, so they thought, oh, she's already got this familiarity with them. And obviously, she has amazing comic timing. I think that one of the things that Wayne's World has going for it is amazing timing, and a great editor, too.
Yeah, kudos to Malcolm Campbell, the editor, who worked on the sequel in The American Werewolf in London before this. And Coming to America also before this, which I just happened to watch a few days ago.
Oh, yeah.
And I still like that movie, which is maybe too long. This one's not too long. It's barely an hour and a half. And we've talked about some of the great gags and lines, and they pack a lot of stuff in 90 minutes. You're the editor. We always talk about this. Do you feel like the movie is too long despite its short length? Because sometimes a comedy, even an hour and a half-ish, can be too long.
When you take into account that they're actually making fun of the plot itself as the plot is carrying out, so you don't really have to worry about story beats so much, I would say it's as close to perfect as comedy editing gets.
Oh, I'm glad you said that, because I thought it was well done,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, the pacing's excellent. You're always laughing. You're always entertained. And when it ends, they leave you wanting more, which is as good as it gets.
I was reading that Myers was not happy with the final product, and I don't know why. Then he is tough to work with, and maybe in a good way. He's pushing people harder. Seth Green's commented when they do the Austin Powers movies, yeah, it's not easy doing these things. But then he's working with them playing two different characters in those movies. Well, three, actually, and four, for that matter, when he gets a Goldmember.
Well, if Seth Green is slamming him, he has lots of company, including Penelope Spheeris, who has not been coy about how difficult he was to work with, even though it was his first starring film role before he had any clout to push people around. An unnamed executive was quoted as saying, "I actively root against him," because they had so many problems working with him here. And again, when he made his next film, So I Married an Axe Murderer, which was directed by Thomas Schlamm.
Schlammy, I think Schlammy, I said that.
Who had the same complaints about him. And then that film bombed, and that didn't stop him from pushing people around still every movie after that. He was apparently, as you already said, pretty apprehensive about having Carvey do Garth, as we already said. He was worried he might be able to bully his own ideas. Other than just the pushiness, there's lots of claims that he is very moody on set and prone to temper tantrums, including a famous story about how he stormed off the set of Wayne's World because there was no margarine for his bagel. It could explain why he's only made 20 films. But in 2013, I think, in an interview, Spheeris said that she forgave him for everything when she saw Austin Powers because she found him so profoundly talented and she loved that movie so much that she was like, you know what? It's worth it. Remember when, like, Dieter got ungreenlit because he was unsatisfied with the script? He was going to make $20 million for that film.
I think kudos for that. He's actually taking a stand and saying, this is not going to be a good movie because the script isn't good enough.
Yeah, and he cost the production of Shrek $2 million when he insisted on re-recording all of his lines with a Scottish accent.
I never understood that one because it's a voiceover. The lip flap on an animated character, which is actually usually done after you do the voiceover, and maybe they already started doing it, but why would it be that out of sync that would cost millions of dollars to fix that?
Because he's not going
to
read it exactly the same. Anyone who's done ADR work can tell you it's not going to be exactly the same.
Okay, fine. Well, Shrek made its money back and then some, so it wasn't cool at the time, I guess, but yeah. Shrek was a monster hit, and it's still beloved, as is that character. He's done 4 Shrek movies, 3 Austin Powers movies, 2 Wayne's World movies in his career. That's about half of the movies he's ever made. His most recent one was obviously Bohemian Rhapsody, as the record executive who doesn't think that song is going to be a hit. That's obviously a meta thing as well. He's big on meta. And then he and Dana Carvey did the thing where the actors come out and they talk about, this movie's up for Best Picture, and they were the most fun people I think they did it that night, of the 8 people that presented.
Well, they reprised their roles. They did it in character. Not in costume, but in character.
And you don't see Carvey do anything much anymore. Maybe stand-up specials. He's not really in movies, like I said, very often. I don't think he's ever been at the Oscars. If he has, I can't remember it.
He had some bombs, but I also heard that he got sick.
Oh, yeah. He nearly died.
Yeah.
He's one of those people that could have just been off this green earth, as Mark Ruffalo could have died from a brain hemorrhage. And I think it was something like that with Carvey, or something very serious. Not just, oh, he's in bad shape, he needs to take a year off or something like that. We could have lost him altogether. I've always liked Dana Carvey. Seems like a pretty good guy. And, of course, he steals the movie from the bigger star. Although, hey, Myers is great, too. He wrote the script with Bonnie and Terry Turner. I think they're married. They were on SNL as writers, and that's where he met them. And then, I didn't know this, they're the ones that created and wrote Third Rock from the Sun.
Oh, wow.
And they've got other credits, too, but those are 2 big ones right there. That's a career. They could retire on those residuals from that show alone. The movie's 185:1. We watched the DVD, which was fine. It aged well enough.
You don't need an IMAX screen to watch Wayne's World.
This is true. Cinematographer Theo Van de Sand shot Blade a few years later, and then a lot of shitty Adam Sandler comedies. Maybe hooked up with Sandler through Mike Myers. We talked about the editor, so the composer J. Peter Robinson did music on Cocktail before this and Detroit Rock City, appropriately headbanger-type characters again after this. We mentioned Spheeris a minute ago being a heavy metal character, a fan of it, I should say. I remember in the commentary that whenever they would do some of that heavy metal-type stuff, she'd be saying things like, yeah, man, yeah!
Oh, that's so cute.
So even though she had her problems with Myers, whenever they did the commentary, it would have been years later, because now if you do a commentary, I don't even know if they do commentaries anymore, but when they did, a lot of times you hear them say, the premiere's tonight. So the movie hasn't even been released yet. Only critics maybe have seen it, or even just executives at the studio and the actors and directors and whatnot. So they don't know how it's going to be received, or if it's going to be successful with awards and critics and all that kind of thing, or if it's going to make a ton of money. But when she did that commentary, it would have logically been years later. Maybe she did it for the, what do you call it, Laserdisc. But even that would have been after 1992. So when she did that, the whole experience with Myers was in her rear view by quite a few years. And she still, as I remember, wasn't saying that fucking asshole. She maybe said some things about him, but I remember her being that negative in the commentary.
In the end, they made a great movie together, so how mad can you stay at somebody when you make something that's this beloved for this many years?
It's easy for me to say about this because I'm not the one who had to go through months of pain and anguish with a guy who's being an ass, who's barely been in a movie, well, never been in a movie before. But I do remember Michael J. Fox's line, Robert Zemeckis said to him in Back to the Future, pain is temporary, film is forever. And this film is one of those that's forever. There's a lot of connections, including some of the great lines and quotes. We've talked about We're Not Worthy and You Did Not already, which people still do to this day, and it has not aged that well, but at the time it was huge. Not.
It's kind of come full circle, and it's now making fun of itself whenever you say it. After Borat, I think.
He did it great.
Yeah.
Party On, of course. They said that a ton. Schwing. An AFI quote. It was nominated for the quotes list, as was We're Not Worthy. How was We're Not Worthy on the quotes list? It would probably be now if they redid it, because it's taken on a life of its own. Sure, right. That one, I'd never heard that before. Them saying excellent the way they did, although Bill and Ted did it before them, so maybe that's not their thing.
That's a good point.
And then Denied.
They actually owe quite a debt to Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure mm-hmm. in general.
Yeah, they're not stoners.
This never would have gotten greenlit without Bill and Ted's success.
Those guys aren't actually stoners, I suppose, either, but they come across that way.
Yeah, they're just kind of dopes.
And Wayne and Garth kind of do, too. Garth seems like he's had something really happen to him with inhalation of smoke in his lifetime.
And I will say, even though it's completely faded out now, but in the year of our Lord, 1992... calling someone a sphincter boy was hilarious.
That one hasn't aged well.
No, it's so dumb.
As far as the awards and list section, no Oscar nominations, which I guess is not surprising. What would it have been? The script, maybe? That's about all it would have gotten. But it was nominated for a few AFI lists, and I think it could have made all of them. The Top 100 Laughs, I'd put it on there. Top 100 Quotes, I just mentioned, Schwing and We're Not Worthy. Not Schwing, but We're Not Worthy should have made that quotes list. I never liked that quotes list very much. And the Top 100 Songs, Bohemian Rhapsody. And we've talked before that there are songs in there that are not originals to those movies. So how in the name of God is that song not on there? Even if just put it at 100.
Such an iconic scene. That's probably the only one that I would agree with you on, because while it's meaningful that we love this movie because we were there in the right time and place when it came out, I don't think this is a forever movie. I think this is a zeitgeist movie.
But did you laugh? And do people still care about We're Not Worthy bowing to people? That's true, isn't it?
I don't know. Do they? Ask someone under 30. Ask someone under 30 and someone over 50.
The bowing thing?
Yeah.
You know where you see that? Watch wrestling.
Oh, okay.
If Vince McMahon comes out, he doesn't really appear all that much anymore. They'll bow to him. Somebody who hasn't been on the scene for a few years, some old veteran comes out, often they'll get bowed to in that exact same way that Wayne and Garth do. Well, they don't get down on their knees when they're standing in the aisle at wrestling shows, but you get the point. And that Alice Cooper scene, man. Yes, Pete, it is.
When he holds his hand out, kiss the ring.
Last thoughts on the movie.
Like I said, it's probably going to fade into obscurity despite being the cultural juggernaut it was in the 90s. But I'm satisfied with knowing how much pleasure this film brought me and you and many other Gen Xers. And it's good enough that we can still go back and watch it without cringing, which feels like a real accomplishment.
I don't agree it's going to fade into obscurity. I think the movie's funny, and funny lasts. And I mentioned it could have been the last list, partly, maybe even mostly, because so many of those movies are older, and they're not all that funny.
Well, that's my point.
But this is funny still, and it's been 27 years.
To you, because you were there in the time and place. People who were there in the time and place for the producers still think it's one of the funniest movies ever made, but I watch it now as an adult for the first time, and I don't get it.
Well, I laughed at it quite a bit. Not the whole way through like this one, not consistently like this. Well, the movies from the 30s and the 40s and some of the 50s movies that are on there, that laughs list, that's what I'm talking about. But at the very least, the song should have been on the songs list, which is one of the worst ones they ever did. And that quotes list, for that matter. Because that quotes list was not worthy. When we return in 7 days, we're going to dodge bullets and say, whoa, as we review something that's still very zeitgeisty and still very famous, and I think still beloved, The Matrix. I couldn't think of anything good for the coming attractions trivia, but here's what I came up with. The Matrix is one of three Keanu Reeves movies we're planning to review in 2019. Now, keep in mind, we do anniversaries a lot, whether it be 10 years or 20 years or 15, 25, fives and tens is what we do a lot with the anniversaries. So can you guess what the other two movies will be? You or anyone else? Do you even know?
I mean, I probably should know, so I definitely won't be guessing when we come back next week. And for the answer to that question, check out next week's podcast about The Matrix. But what if you just can't wait until then and you need lots more Ryan and Bev in your life? Well, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts. While you're there, check out our entire roster. We've covered hundreds of movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it's not case sensitive.
May I just say, Sha Wing.
Sha.
Right.
And cut. Party on, Ryan.
Party on, Garth.